We've tried to tailor this sort of as a boot camp for explaining sort of what IP is and how it relates to your space, and to give you some sort of information about the context and the framework within which IP works in your space and how it's important to you guys, and hopefully it fills that gap. So, what is intellectual property? And if you're like me 23 years ago, you know nothing about it. I'm sure you guys probably know more about it than I did 23 years ago, but it basically refers to a class of intangible assets that are developed by people. And IP rights are legislated rights in various countries in the world, in fact, pretty much all countries in the world, that protect the exclusivity of these, the ability to practice these intellectual assets in these various countries. And the rights are, as indicated, legislated by country. So Canada has laws for protecting intellectual property rights of different sorts. So there are sort of five general classes of IP rights. There's patents that protect inventive concepts, functions, devices, methods. Sort of the these are typically what people think of as being the most valuable class of intellectual property rights, because they stop others from being able to practice something in the marketplace. Trademarks, Ben?
Oh, sure. Trademarks are basically you have some way of distinguishing your product or service from others. It usually indicates a single source of the quality. So Coca-Cola is a popular one, but they may license it out for other people to resell. And in the software world, same thing, you might white label things or have some control if you have a strong brand. I'd say these days with startups and things like a lot of people like to pick like these four letter single word company names these days. There's just a lot of is this an introduction or is this supposed to be a full thing? But you know, a lot of people like to pick, you know, single word four letters, you know, these days, and very like highly descriptive or suggestive of what the services are. So I mean, there's a lot of traps that are possible. Like if you pick the wrong name, or people like to just use their own name as the trademark. And again, like Rogers is a big company. So in Canada, you can actually never trademark Rogers just because it's someone's name, things like that. So, but they can do like Rogers cable or Rogers cell phone, but they can never do Rogers on its own. So like, it's just good to pick a good name up front and get to know what the problems are.
So they're investments. I mean, so with patents, your investments are your intellect and what you've developed over time. And so what you try to do is protect the functionality and products that you develop as a result of those intellectual resources. With trademarks, it's marketing investments. So you spend time advertising your brand, building up a name for yourself, spending good time and money, ensuring that your support for your brand, you know, making sure customers are happy. So that builds. That's an investment. So the trademarks protect that investment.
I have a question.
Sorry, of course.
So trademarks, Are they constrained to the realm of only name?
No.
They say it's like words or a combination of lots of stuff. So it's kind of symbolic stuff, right?
Yeah. If you look at Ben's cup on the other side of the yeah, there you go. There's a logo. So that is I believe a trademarked logo.
Yes. It is.
With respect to coffee.
Yeah.
There are colors. So there are different insurance companies, different cell phone companies that use a single color. HSBC, the Hong Kong bank with the orange, what is it? I can't recall the name of the bank, but they basically have the color orange trademark.
Tangerine,
maybe, yeah. Smells, certain companies use a particular smell to distinguish themselves. And so when you walk into a store, they smell a certain way. It's anything that will make a person associate your product and or services with that brand, and you know, build up that sense of trustability and value and goodwill.
So these kind of definition can go very far, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So there's
In the case where you said color, did they need to create that color, or can Coke tomorrow say no one else can use red?
Okay, so colors are a bit different. So a lot of trademarks you can just apply and get a registration and kind of prove later that you've used it. For all the secondary type of trademarks, you do need to show some distinctiveness. So Harley Davidson Sam was trademarked, or Louis Louboutin Red Sole Shoes were trademarked in some countries. But that's like, they not only had to show it, they had to show that it was already distinctive in the marketplace. If you want a name, that's a little easier test. You can just go for the name and get that applied, but you may have to show smells, like perfumes and things like that. Like you would actually have to deposit it and prove that this is a very distinctive smell and color too. Like, you know, fashion, they don't like to give out color because it's kind of unfair. So you really need to show that it's really distinctive to you. So the short answer is yes, there's secondary markers. There's also unregistered rights, so sometimes you can kind of prove it just to the court. Like, you don't have to show the trademark office that you had this sort of reputation, and then they balance fairness of the marketplace as well as the monopoly that they think you deserve. So the short answer is yes. Like, you can get all these weird things, but for a lot of them, you need to prove it, survey evidence and things like that.
Yeah. Often companies in the early stages won't have all their trademarks set up the way they will ultimately be used. So they'll come up with product names and deal with them later when they've got a proper marketing team and where they're getting close to the ability to deliver the service or product. So it's usually less of a concern to start than a patent application is, but yeah, it is still something that should be considered in terms of a company name. So three other types of protections are industrial designs. That is for the non-functional ornamentation shape of a product. So for example, a Coca-Cola bottle is recognizable, it's got a nice feel to it, and they've actually got protection for their the shape of their bottle. Copyrights, as you know, protect literary works such as music, literature, so it's an expression of an idea. And trade secrets are confidential information that you would protect within your company. So for example, and this is a terrible example, but I'll use it anyway, the secret formula for Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's something that they maintain that gives them the semblance of an advantage over their competitors, because nobody else will be able to do the exact same thing. So most of the talk will focus on patents, because I feel that's probably of most value to you guys. Patents, as you may or may not know, are limited time monopolies to exclude others from making, using, selling, and importing an invention. The invention must be, to get a patent, the invention must be new, non-obvious, and useful. And we'll explain this in a second. Patents are regional, or more importantly, national. So each country has their own laws to provide the ability to obtain a patent. And less important, these next 2 points, but they are expensive. They are something to be considered, but they are very valuable. So companies do invest their money into getting patents, because they do, like I said, protect the investment of the company in developing a product or a solution, etc. They are also labor intensive, so they take a bit of time for the patent agent and for the company employees to develop, because they are a full disclosure. They are like a, in many ways, like a technical paper that you would submit to a journal. They have to disclose a fair bit of information, enough for the particular audience in a particular manner. They are constructed in a certain manner, and that's why Ben and I do prepare these kinds of applications all day long. So we are better versed at it, but we also need a lot of technical details from the employees of the companies that we work with.
So could you share a little bit of your daily experience with this? How many people do you work with at the same time? How long does it then actually take?
Sure.
Yeah.
It varies from company to company. So we do work with a number of large multinationals and work with, you know, hundreds of inventors at these companies. So the large companies will have a patent organization from the company that will cooperate with us and will coordinate providing us information about each idea they want to get a patent for. And then there's other companies that are smaller and, I may know somebody who needs some work done in this space and wants to get a patent, and so I will work directly with that one person. It typically takes sort of in a pinch, we can usually do them in a week, but we usually take about 4 weeks to draft an application because we need to fit them into our schedule. We need to get information from inventors, and sometimes they are busy. There is some back and forth, so once we've drafted the patent application, we have the inventors review them, and they will make corrections and send them back to us. We'll have a discussion, correct some more information, and then eventually finish the application and file it. And that usually is in the 4-week range, roughly. That's a guess. That is a guess, but that can be accelerated or lengthened depending on the circumstances.
Does it differ between quantum and AI or blockchain?
I'd say anything deep tech is kind of the same, like, you know, some back and forth, some homework, some discussion, talk about all alternatives and implementations. So I'd say anything like on the deeper tech, it's kind of the same time anyway.
Mm-hmm. And does the length of the document vary, or?
So I'm going to give you an answer. I think it does for quantum technologies, because with AI, it's a bit more established. There's a bit more history. Some of the examiners of patent offices have more knowledge, and you have to explain less to them. With quantum computing, there's less experience at the patent office, so we're constantly educating examiners, the people who look at the patent applications on the government side, to decide whether or not you get a patent and what the scope of it is, the protection. And so you have to educate them more, provide more information. It's a bit of a black hole because we don't have a ton of experience with the patent office and quantum computing applications or quantum communication applications. So we provide them more information if possible. So it does often end up being a little bit longer of an application,
mm-hmm.
But not tremendously longer, just a little bit more. I like providing more context to make it easier for the examiners to get a sense of how this invention that you guys have come up with is really quite different from everything else out there.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, we provide some contextual information.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in AI, it's just a little bit more obvious and some
it's becoming more pervasive. So
right. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, and the examiner sits in a governmental
yes.
office.
Yeah, so I mean, effectively, the idea is that the patent agent helps the inventor put together a patent application. And then the patent office will look at the application, and we'll get into this in a second when I go over the parts of the patent application. But the goal is to consensually come up with what is distinguishing about your invention compared to everything else out there. And that's what you're entitled to as a limited time monopoly, to figure out what the invention is the important part. So the requirements for patent applications, patents are that they must be new, they haven't been done before, not obvious, so you can't just take something that's patented and change the color, and it must be useful. And useful is a strange word, but it must have some commercial value to someone. And a fourth weird requirement is that it must be directed to a statutory subject matter. So the government decides from time to time that certain things shouldn't be patented, so unapplied scientific principles or theorems, because you're basically applying for something that's so broad that it's unfair. Methods of medical treatment, because you don't want doctors to be hindered by to treat somebody. Life forms, because they don't want tampering with that nature of science. And then strangely, games and method of playing games. And this is an odd one, but it is what it is. So parts of an application, this is important because it helps explain what a patent actually is. So most of a patent application is disclosing information. So in exchange for disclosing information about your invention and making it publicly available, so teaching others about your invention, the government grants you a limited time monopoly. This is from a historical tool that took sort of skills that were transferred. I think it was from linen factories. They encouraged linen factory owners in mainland Europe to come to England to run a factory and teach others about the way they would manufacture lemons, and in exchange, they would grant them a limited time monopoly to produce lemon in their inventive way. So that's how the system generally arose. So you basically have to disclose something, and in exchange, you get this limited time monopoly. So the disclosure is the background. It just provides some contextual information to the reader to understand, you know, what currently the state of the art is. The disclosure, which is, you know, what your system does, how it works, why it's neat. Then we end up, we also include the drawings in the disclosure, so the drawings accompany the description and help explain how the system works. And then we get to the claims. The claims are the part that you and the government argue over to figure out what the scope of the monopoly is, so what you have invented versus everything else that's out there. This is the real struggle for us as patent agents in terms of crafting them to be able to serve our clients the best. We try to get as much protection as possible without having exposed our clients to the chance of invalidating a patent because the claims are too broad. So we try to claim as broadly as possible but without reading on prior art, current state of the art. And then there's also forms. There's an abstract which used to be used when these documents were stuck in a box or put in a library and people would read abstract cards. They're mostly ignored at this point in time because of electronic databases. And then there's forms that we complete to provide information about the details of the inventors, the applicant, etc. So there are different kinds of patent applications. One that you'll probably have heard of is a provisional patent application. This is a U.S. term, and it's basically a placeholder. It's like you submit an article that is secretly held by the government but can serve later as a priority document to show that you have already disclosed on a particular day your invention. So it isn't examined. It simply serves as a placeholder, but it's important that it discloses your invention in enough detail to what they call enable it. So that a person who works in your space has to be able to read that document, understand what the invention is, and then actually make a system without too much fussing that does the same thing that you do. So that's the level of detail that's required. Often people will file provisional patent applications without meeting those requirements. They'll simply scratch some ideas down on a piece of paper and file it. It's dangerous if they rely on that. Full applications are what are examined and issued a patent. So you can file this drawing priority from the earlier date of the provisional application, or you can file without a provisional application. These are generally national applications that are examined, that are have met the full requirements that we've gone through before, but the description and the claims, and that can issue a patent. And once they issue a patent, they can be enforced against other parties who are practicing the same invention without your approval, license, etc. I won't get into it, but there are a bunch of ways that you can structure how you file these applications, when you file them. But basically, the idea is that this is the application type that you would file to be able to enforce against other people, and that gets you value. So this relates to your question about what the process is. Clients often come to us and say, we know our art field, we know that this is inventive, so we want to prepare a patent application. Sometimes, once in a while, we get a client who doesn't know and isn't sure whether they want to spend a large amount of money on preparing a patent application. And so they want to explore, you know, what else has been done at that point. So we can do a patentability search and see what else is out there. It's limited in patent cases. Patent applications are only published after 18 months. So you don't get to see what anybody has filed in the last 18 months. That's a bit of a black hole. But you do get to see everything 18 months onwards. So once the client has decided you want to prepare an application, you work with the client, like we said, to prepare the application, so 2 to 4 weeks. We then file it. and then we wait. After 18 months, like I said, the application is published. Examination, so when the examiner at the patent office looks at it, it's, you know, a good range because of the different levels of busyness of the different examiners in different fields. It can be short, you know, I've even seen 6 months, but typically it's sort of in the 24-month range, 18 to 24-month range. The examiners.
This is U.S. or U.S.
This is a typical U.S. application. The timelines change from country to country, but for the most part, this is mirrored every country. The examiner will then point out any issues he has with your application. If he thinks that maybe you've described something incorrectly, if he thinks that your claims are you're trying to claim something that is including what has already been done, then they will raise an objection and you have to respond to that. So there's some back and forth with the patent office, with the examiner, about your application. Once you guys agree, you and the examiner, on the scope and the application to fix all the issues the examiner has with it, you get a notice of allowance. And that is a glorious day when they tell you to pay an issue fee and that your application will issue the patent. And once it issues the patent, you can then enforce against other people, or at least threaten to. I didn't mention here that once it's filed, any application, either a provisional or a full application, you can say your patent pending. And it can be, at least based on the disclosure you provided, it can be sometimes safe to show other people what you filed. So why patents? It, like I said, protects the innovations and the investments you've made in R&D. It deters other people from entering the same space, which can be really important in emerging markets. They're marketing tools, so the fact that you can say that your service or your product is patent pending or patented can sort of add weight to it from a marketing perspective. It can show investors and other parties that your company is knowledgeable, and it will, and this is probably the most important thing for you guys, it will assure investors that their investments will be protected. So investors, when they are exploring whether to invest in a company with technology or an individual with technology, they want to know that somebody else won't be able to copy them immediately and run off with the idea. So they want to know that patent applications are being filed. Down the road, there's licensing revenue you can get once you obtain a patent. There's cross-licensing we won't talk about, and it increases ultimately the value of your company because it is an asset that can be sold by itself. So when to file patent applications? It's important to file as soon as you can. So this depends on the maturity of your technology. You need to know how to explain to somebody how to make your system or practice your method fully enough so that another person can come along, read your disclosure, your application, and do the same thing without having to scratch their heads and do some trial and error research. Some countries allow you a one-year grace period. So typically, because patents were a trade for disclosing your invention, and in return you get the monopoly, if you disclose your invention already, there was no benefit to countries granting you a monopoly in exchange for, again, disclosing your invention. Some countries give you a one-year grace period. So if you disclosed it in the last year, for example, Canada and the US, you can file a patent application within that one-year period and still ultimately obtain a valid patent. Other countries, many Europeans, for example, don't give you that right. Once you've disclosed your invention, you're, for the most part, done. You can't get a patent.
Is this for inventions or products that are like finalized? Mm-hmm. Like what if the description of your product changes?
It's a good question. Then?
Yeah.
So if you think that your product is at least doable and workable and works in its current form, there are different strategies. Number one, you can file a full application, but what we often do in that case is recommend, if we think that the client feels that the product is still emerging and evolving, we will tell them to file a full provisional application. So, meaning that we will draft a full application, but only file it as a provisional. And then as the product is developed further and changes are made, we would file a subsequent provisional when we get enough information. And then, you know, at some point in time, within that 1 year period from the first filing, we would crystallize everything, ensure we've got a description which matches the current knowledge of the client, and then file as a full application.
Okay. Thanks.
And the so when I did say that the provisional application needed to be sort of full in terms of explaining it, if resources are that you can't engage people like Ben or myself to help, you try to do your best and explain everything and file, you know, yourself. They're not expensive at all to file. It's $150 US, roughly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and sometimes researchers, and we see this a lot, like their standard is fairly intense, right? Because, you know, every sentence you say has to be true, has to be cited and vetted. So that's kind of one path. Like, we kind of have a certain standard that we need for disclosure. So that's sort of one aspect of it. The second part is like results. So sometimes you might simulate it. So you kind of know what the theory is, but you haven't simulated it yet. So results, people are kind of on the fence. To me, I mean, me personally, I like adding results just to kind of show, you know, this was an experiment was done. So maybe like you've done the theory, we filed a provisional, top it up with results, right? So that kind of, but you still may, in the eventual claim, get the benefit of the earliest date, because that's when you proposed the theory, and you just may have like proved it or actually had like statistical numbers that backed up the thing. So, you know, a lot of scientists may wait too long and say, you know, I need this fully vetted, fully cited. But really, you know, if it's reproducible and logical and fully disclosed, even though you didn't simulate it, that may be the time to call us or that sort of thing. So, and sometimes you may, you know, there may be a little area where you might not have a full citation, but I mean, for us, like I put it in.
But what if you end up with a different result that you expected? So you're actually doing something else.
Yep. Then you change your disclosure and you file again. If you're filing provisional applications because they're cheap to file.
Yeah.
And there's no consequence, really. You revise it and refile it, or you file a full application based on the revised method or device.
Okay.
So we live in the filing date world, so yeah. It's like you file something, everything before that date, this is the timeline in my hand, everything before that date is prior art to you, and then you hit your date, and then everything after that can't be used against you ever, like not legally, even if, you know, there's some ideas that were out there, like if it's not published, like they're not, after that date, they're stuck. So. Yeah, if you came up with something totally different, then it just means we filed. You get the later date. Let's just assume we collected both and presented both inventions that were opposite, or you just filed the new invention. It's like then that's just the later date. That if you have filed something on that date, then again you just kind of draw that as your line in the sand, and again anything before that date is now kind of the new de facto date of your invention.
Yeah, so let's say you file a provisional patent application on January 1st of this year, and it discloses system one that you've got, and then you go with system two on May 1st, and then you file a full application on that. And then you have claims, and if the claims are disclosed enough by the information that you disclosed on January 1, then only publications that existed before that date can be used against you. If those claims are only any one claim is supported only by the May 1 disclosure, then May 1 is the date before which any publications can be used against you. So it's important to file as early as possible so that you can avoid other companies from making publications that will reduce your ability to get strong patent protection.
I see.
So different kinds of innovations that we have seen in the quantum technology space are for quantum computers that you guys know are a combination of classical computer systems and quantum hardware. On the quantum hardware side, the kinds of innovations we would see are, you know, the types of qubits, gates, sensors, qubit lifetime, so the focus on improving the coherence of a system. Error correction to address the coherence of a system once it happens, and scaling to be able to tie together more and more qubits. On the classical computer system side, so this is relating more to this space, programming platforms. So for example, I can't even recall for the life of me what IBM's platform is called.
Qiskit, I guess.
Sorry?
Is it the quantum platform or is
yes,
it?
So IBM has a...
IBM Q or Qiskit? Qiskit, I think, is called the...
No, that isn't...
The programming...
But IBM has this, a programming platform for programming.
Quantum. Qiskit, right?
It's a generalized...
What else?
Yeah, I think it's Qiskit.
It must be Qiskit, whatever.
I can't recall what it's called. I apologize.
Yeah,
but it's really a software set that then ties to a driver set that then talks to the particular quantum hardware that you have. So the programming platforms are patentable algorithms for types of problems that are solved on quantum computers are patentable. Algorithms we typically tie into a particular computer that's very generalized, or we'll talk about a method that is related to the hardware.
Well, I guess Shor's algorithm is not patented. Is it?
Well, I don't know if it is. It probably isn't, but it is certainly patentable. If a client told us about it and we hadn't told the world yet, it would be patentable because what you would do is you would say, you know, a computer system programmed in a certain way to solve this kind of problem, to come up with prime numbers. If nobody had done that before, then it would be patentable.
It's already like disclosed for so long.
Yeah, it's been disclosed.
How old is the Shor's algorithm?
It's like 1992, is that
right? Right. Very, very long time.
So even if you got a patent for it, it would be expired by now. Because patents are only good for 20 years from the date of filing.
But where's really the boundary between company and just scientific research then? Like, do you need to have a company to file a patent, I guess? Is
no. No, we deal with a lot of individuals who have ideas, haven't figured out how to commercialize it yet, but they want to at least try to beat everybody to the patent office and establish an early date of disclosure with the patent office so that only prior art, only documents published before that can be used against them. And they oftentimes we'll get some very, very strong companies arising from those situations where some guy sitting in his basement has an idea.
And, or a girl.
I apologize, I'm sorry, yes. And as a result, they don't have the know-how to establish the company, but it gives them a start point, starts a clock by at which they have to, he or she has to, you know, organize everything and figure out how to make this company work, or at least even how to make it appealing to an investor. We will talk to individuals who have ideas and patent them for them.
Yeah, we've done lots of academia investors. It depends on the tech transfer policy, whether their small company can own it, they own it personally, or their department owns it. So, and every university is different. I haven't looked at the ones here recently.
But they'd approach you with the intention of eventually...
Yeah, so if they don't own it, then the university might take over the cost and the process. They might... So a lot of it starts with a disclosure to your department and the university, and then they kind of agree where it is. So every university in Canada is different. Like, some of them are very... inventor-owned and favorable. Some of them are more university kind of takes over and helps the commercialization. But usually it's driven by the researcher or professor. So for example, if you have a supervisor, sometimes like automatically, like they're part of the process automatically. You know, whereas some of the other universities is basically inventor-owned, and they can do whatever they want. So I haven't looked at the policy here, but the point is we've done it. Like, we're comfortable, and then the professor may own it individually until they figure out what to do with it. Create a new shell company, spin out, or just give it to the university, and they get the licensing team on it. More often than not, the professor has to be intimately involved. They can't just like leave it as paper and hope the university will commercialize it for them. Like, usually, you know, they're kind of part of it.
Right. Yeah, I guess what I was just trying to understand was whether if, you know, someone has, you know, just written a paper and filed a patent, you know, can other people still just write another paper building on the research in a normal kind of research style, right? Like,
interesting idea. So if you file a patent application with a certain disclosure of knowledge set A, that doesn't stop other people from developing improvements on your knowledge set and getting patents on that improvement to your knowledge set. But it, you know, assuming that you are the first person to disclose this knowledge set A and it is inventive, new, then you can get a patent on that knowledge set. But again, it doesn't stop you from, stop others from being able to improve you and then block you down the road from improving your system with their improvements, let's say. And it doesn't stop you from, it doesn't stop others from simply providing publications, articles in journals about improvements to your technology. It happens all the time.
Yeah, so often, like, there might be, like, with new research, like, a bunch of pioneering patents that are strong and robust, so, like, early 90s, like, 3D printing patents, there are a bunch. So that's why, you know, you didn't hear a lot, and then early 2010s, this, like, huge explosion of 3D printing stuff, because a lot of those pioneering patents came off patent. But they can do improvement patents to the processes or this 3D printing thing, and then try to evergreen or try to get another 20 years from that date. So there are overlapping patents and whatnot. So, I mean, you're not pharmaceutical people, but, like, you know, you get the drug, you get the chemical formula, that's 20 years. But you may have new treatments.
Delivery methods,
whatever you can get, dosages, regimens for that drug, as long as it's not obvious, and then you try to get every day for pharmaceutical companies, like hundreds of millions. So any extension of life they can get, they try to. So the point, but then third parties can also try to get improvements as well once they got the original drug formula. So I guess the takeaway is there are overlapping patents, as long as one is an improvement or a non-obvious over the first one. And then, you know, if you do it for yourself, then you're trying to get some more patent life over it.
But generally, anything that you would think of as inventive, generally, in your space at least, we can likely get a patent application issued to patent on. It's not a subject field that is taboo from a patent perspective, such as medical treatment or working with genes, etc.
We did a lot of cannabis patents.
I'm so curious about these criteria that you said, you know, like usefulness. I mean, right? Like, that is for us. I'm like, is any of this useful, right?
Well, quantum computing, that's clear. Like, KD, like quantum communication.
I think they mean industrial utility and not, like...
But, like, you know, kind of provably, like, you know, it has a provable quantum advantage, stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty low bar.
For kids, like, has a clear use.
To convince other people to believe that it is useful,
right?
Instead of being really useful.
Can you patent an idea, or does it have to be that you made some progress to being able to do it?
It's like the forecast thing.
It has to be.
Clearly, could be sold as useful.
That's right.
I'm sorry.
It has to be embodied in some kind of physical method or device for you to patent it. You have to be able to concretely indicate to somebody else how you would use your idea. And you also have to limit it somewhat to a practical approach for using the idea.
So just going back, say, 30 years or 25 years, could Jeff Bezos have patented the idea that you can buy something online?
Absolutely. So if you look at the patent for the one-click idea, it was the use of cookies tied with an identifier in a cookie tied to a database that stored your mailing address, your credit card information,
so that when you clicked on a button, you'd be able to pull up that information and process payment and then start the order on the back end. That was a different use for cookies than they had been used with up to that point.
Mm.
So that actually was deemed inventive and patents were obtained.
But if it was just, I'm going to do a website to buy stuff, would he have been able to then have the only e-commerce website in the world?
Invented in the 50s, maybe, and the little transistor.
Yes.
Yeah. And there were things out there like that. I mean, if you look at, I'll give you a rough example, Adobe Acrobat. So they had patents on the PDF format, and they maintained a monopoly for 20 years. And then as soon as the patent expired, like Ben said, there was a thousand different products that were in that space. So they can establish an entire market segment for you, for your own personal enjoyment. I mean, pharmaceuticals are the exact same way. If you get a patent on a particular class of drug, then you can own that market for 20 years. Yeah, I think some of that. Antidepressant drugs or anti-anxiety drugs are. It's really interesting to see how those markets, what happens at the end of those 20 years is almost like it just proliferates everywhere as soon as the patent expires. But usually it has to be like either, at minimum, like talking about the utility, like in a computer or painting some physical thing. A new manufacturing process is an idea, but you're manipulating a physical piece of cloth or something. Or the computer kind of, that's the debatable part, but like ideally it's a technical advantage in the computer itself.
And not just
or an idea into a computer as a mere tool. Yeah, you can't, for example, patent a method for scamming people by telling them information that's not true. And then, because there is no sort of, beyond the person, there's no physical implementation of the method. So in your space, like I said, patent examiners and patents in general, there aren't many of them in the quantum technology space. As a result, the examiners are green. They are being pulled in from other areas because they can't hire. There are so few people in your space who know what they're doing. It's really hard for them to hire at patent offices people who have knowledge. So they are getting examiners from other areas and retraining them to do this kind of work. As a result, we have to spend more time and draft longer applications, like I said, to better explain the technology. They are more likely to give you patents with protection that is broader than you would in other fields. So there's an opportunity at this point in time. So a patent is, once granted, deemed to be valid until proven invalid. So if you can get claims that might possibly be bad in view of other publications out there through the patent office in a patent, that still poses a big challenge for companies who are competitors of yours, because they have to first invalidate their patent. Their patent is first deemed valid, and they would have to deal with the consequences of that, you know, by you suing them for patent infringement. They would then have to challenge the validity of your patent. But first of all, it's deemed valid. So the benefit here today is that you can get broad claims through because of the lack of experience of examiners. Well, it's just part of the education process in this space to spend more time with the examiner, trying to bring them up to speed, get them to understand the technology. Even though you write a good disclosure, you still have to help them understand the technology. As a result, I mean, this sounds crazy, but that communication time builds some kind of trust. And they, as a result, are more often to take your word for what the invention is and how broad it is. So strategies regarding patents. Competitive intelligence. Knowing what your competitors do allows you to understand how you guys are different. And that helps you determine, you know, when you should file a patent application, how broad your patent application might be, when you should think about patenting. So if you think that you're distinct from everybody else, maybe it's the time, and you can explain, you know, how to do what is distinct about your product, and that's probably the time to think about patenting. If
you are developing a solution and you are getting close to being at a point where your technology is mature, you will need to start thinking about patenting. And Ben can talk more about this, but there are programs out there for helping you fund the protection of IP. I'll let Ben.
Yeah, and you know, there's probably resources here at Perimeter as well, but you know, I've got kind of a list of which programs will fund your patent, you know, which funds will help commercialization, and some of them will even help with like this whole branding strategy that we talked about earlier. But some of them do pay for like provisional patent application and full on patent applications as well, and they're all help at different stages, whether it's like really early or post revenue. The point is that they exist, so it'll help defray some of the costs. But obviously, you know, viability and commercial marriage and all those things aren't considered. But some of them can get a bit earlier on the earlier stages, especially since you're affiliated with an academic institution. Some of the grants like that, and they like the fact that people are thinking about commercialization and IP. Because you know a lot of the goals are to get things away from the lab and into the marketplace, especially you know grown in Canada technologies.
Yeah, and some of these organizations and programs will help provide guidance to you to getting you to dealing with you know patent applications, etc.
Yeah.
Establishing your company.
Yeah, or like patent searching and that sort of due diligence. Like even if it's worthwhile, like a lot of them will help with those.
These are mostly points that we can ignore for now. These are basically things to think about when you're drafting a patent application, but not relevant to you. We've already talked about this, that.
Yeah.
And designs is the same.
Yeah, designs, I guess, like, so basically the quick point is you can get graphical user interfaces. So designs are usually like some ornamentation of a physical object, but then the courts and the law have said that a GUI is a design of some sort, even though it's on a screen. So whether it's like your core main user screen or, you know, some sort of integration between classical and quantum and, you know, whatever, like drag and drop boxes or however you want to design your new compiler, if that's like core and looks like it's always going to be the same, it may be worthwhile to throw in a design. So, some weird part of the law is the U.S., they're called design patents, so in theory you're patent pending again, and you can label it as patent pending and patented, even though it's a design patent. So even on Apple, like they said Steve Jobs, oh, he's got hundreds of patents, but like 99% of those were design patents, so but he does have like 300 to his name, and then like 7 were utility patents. But whatever, he is a good designer, but you know, but and they're not raw, they're not fraudulent in saying that he has patents in his name, just in the U.S. their design patents are patents.
So I think for me the underlying theme there is that if you have questions at all about the process and when you should be thinking about this, people like Ben and I are generally quite giving our time in terms of free consults to talk about where you are, what you might think about, when you might think about doing things, what it might cost, how you should plan. So one thing that is a little bit important is the ownership. So typically, people who come up with the ideas own them.
I should say the inventor, not the owner. Oh no, creator is the owner, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you're an employee or a contractor, your agreements that you have with your employer or contractor, I guess it's contractee, might dictate, you know, who owns intellectual property that is generated as a result of your service of the agreement. There are rules regarding, you know, if you work in this space and you develop a solution, a home for, and this is a crazy idea I had, a better way for constructing tea bags. And you do that all hours, at home, with your own tools, the company has no real strong claim to that invention. So it depends on the agreements you have, when you were doing it, is it in the role of your, within your role at the company, what your agreement says, whether you use company resources. You also have institute or university policies regarding research that you may be performing, whereby the university or institution might be entitled to a portion of that in exchange for the services they provide.
Can this ownership be like 50-50? Or it has to be like...
it can be 50-50.
It can be?
Yeah. You can have any split you'd like, frankly. It becomes complicated legally and painful, but it's entirely possible. Typically what they do is they park the ownership of the intellectual property in an organization and then split shares in that organization according to the shares. It makes it easier.
Yeah, especially if you want to sell that patent later, you just want a clean, transfer.
So otherwise you have to get the signatures of it.
Yeah. Many people.
And you guys don't need to see this, but we've been around for a while, and we've got a depth of experience.
Is that right?
1893.
1893.
It's
yes.
Not a typo.
Wow. Not 1983. Not us, though. Just other people.
Joe Biden.
You said it, not me. And that's us.
Add us to LinkedIn. Or... Mm-hmm.
You guys have a lot of customers from the quantum realm right now, or is it...
some, okay. Large and small. Okay. I've done work in the gate space, software platform space.
Mm. That was going to be my next question. Like, what is it mostly based on? Is it a software product or something like?
I've done both hardware and software, so it just depends on the needs of the client. I mean, so my favorite part of our job is that we get paid to learn technology. It's like we're getting paid to go to school.
Yeah.
And it's great. So whatever the client has in terms of technology, we get to learn and then help them describe it in the patent application.
I see.
So it just depends on the needs. We often get pulled into fields that are sort of ancillary or different from ours and learn that.
That's cool.
Mark, I know it's a general question and you can give me a general answer in a range, but what's the order of cost that someone needs to budget for a patent? Is it tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, can it be millions? Like, what are you talking about?
So there is... It depends on the circumstances. To get started is not terribly expensive. I'm going to throw some numbers at you, and they're sort of the, let's call it, if we have a company client that we are going to file an application for, what we quote them is, in a more complicated space, $15,000 to $20,000 to prepare an application and then filing costs on top of that. That can be scaled based on the requirements of the company. But that is, a full-out strong tool that the company then uses to generate revenue. Smaller cases, we often will give discounts to help younger companies out, or we'll structure costs accordingly. It's not a cheap proposition, but they are an asset that you can use in a particular way. So you have to figure out whether it's worth spending that money or not.
But this is Canada, US? Because you said somewhere things are only national, right? So
the way it works is you have to file an application in one country first. And once you've done that, you have a year from that date within which you can file applications in other countries. So there are also tools to allow you to defer the filing in other countries for up to an additional year and a half. But what you have to do is file in one country. Typically, with most things we see in North America, investors want to see a U.S. patent application. Mm-hmm. So that's what we prepare and file.
Is U.S. more complicated because of that? Or
no, I don't think so at all. I think it's actually easier than Canada.
Oh, yeah?
I think so, in terms of subject matter, in terms of rejections.
So the U.S. examiners are better than the Canadian examiners, so you get a report.
Canada has like 1/30th of the volume.
Yeah, and just
1/50th.
The way they subclass it and the examiner's expertise, right? They may be a little more generalist. But I mean, I guess the takeaway is like the U.S. is the most important, and then Canadian company, and then yeah, maybe a Canadian one. Then you look at other countries like Europe and China. But unfortunately, the process does not actually time well. So, like, you know, you're kind of deciding in countries before you even know it's allowable. So that's not great. I mean, there's ways you can kind of game it, but then of course those ways cost money as well. So, but the point is, U.S. let's just say always first, and then decide on the countries as needed as markets. You know, where tech is going.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of application called a patent cooperation treaty application that if you file that as a first application, it's sort of an international holding pattern application. The filing costs are greater, but it buys you 30 months to be able to then decide at which point what countries you want to file in. Mm-hmm. So for the cost of preparing an application, the filing costs of that application, you then can, for the most part, ignore costs for 30 months. And so you can develop your product, figure out a strategy for where you want to build or provide services, then you can pick your other countries. And also in that 30 months, you typically have investor backing. So you can then, you know, have financial ability to file where you need to. Or you don't have that, and you know that maybe your company is not going as well as you thought, and so maybe you scale back. But it buys you that time to be able to decide where you're going to file, because each national application can be expensive.
Can we have these slides?
Oh, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure, like it. I don't know how we'll invite us email those.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay.
Forward your email.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.